Got it.
Okay, the House Resources Committee is called to order today, February 27th at 1:04 p.m. In room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol. Members present are Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Rauscher, Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Divert, Representative McKay and my, or McCabe. And myself, Representative McKay. Sorry about that, Kevin. We do have a quorum present to do business. I see we have Senator Keel with us today. He is our honored guest. Welcome, Senator Keel. And I want to thank the staff here, Kevin and Zach and Ed, for helping us stay organized today. Please silence your cell phones. As far as an opening, we have two items on today's agenda, Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 50. House Bill 49 and the bill regarding CACFA that were scheduled will not be heard today. CACFA. Thanks. The first order of business today is to hear an introduction of Senate Bill 10, which is related to trapping licenses for disabled veterans. We'll bring that before the committee. My intent would be that we could vote SB 10 out today unless there is any objections. So I'd like to invite, and we've been joined by Representative Pakatuk. Thank you, Representative, for being here. And we'll bring SB 10 back before the committee. This is our second hearing on SB 10. And we'll take opening remarks from Senator Keel. We'll accept public testimony on the bill, consider any amendments, and look to the will of the committee. So with that, Senator Keel, would you like to make an opening statement?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel, a senator for District B here in the northern corner of southeast Alaska. I'm joined by Kathy Schlinghide of my staff. I won't repeat the introduction to the bill, Mr. Chairman, that I gave at the previous hearing. Just the brief description is that it adds trapping licenses to the lifetime hunting and fishing licenses for veterans with a 50% or greater service-related disability. And then at the request of the department, it also adds trapping to the annual hunting and fishing licenses that active duty members of the Guard and of the Reserve get. There was a question from Representative Sadler that we needed to research. If it's the will of the chairman, I'll have my staff answer that question now.
Okay, please proceed and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Kathy Schlinghide, staff to Senator Keel. In response to Representative Sadler's question, this does apply only to members of the armed forces, not all uniformed services.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Any other questions from the group? Rep. Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Keel. I think we'd asked, or someone had asked the question, do we know what the universe of potential disabled veterans who would, if all wanted to take advantage of this offer, how many would that be? Do you have a number?
Mr. Chair, again, this is Kathy Schlinghide for the record. In response to Representative Sadler, the department doesn't have an exact number. They know how many people that Senator Keel mentioned last time get trapping licenses, but they don't know how many service disabled vets are among that group.
Mr. Chairman, it is fewer than the roughly 77,000 veterans in the state of Alaska.
Without this year. That's a big number, and we're proud of it. Okay, what I'd like to do next is open the hearing to public testimony. My understanding is we do have a gentleman present that would like to testify. Is that correct?
Yes.
Please come forward and state your name and begin your testimony for us and your affiliation.
Thank you. My name is David Summers. I live here in Juneau, Alaska, although I'm in District 3. And so I'm a United States Army veteran during the Desert Storm era. And then after 9/11, I decided to re-up as a veteran and joined the Alaska National Guard and was deployed in on Operation American Freedom. So I am a veteran. I'm also a disabled veteran. I do hold a disabled veteran's hunting and fishing license. I wanted to make three quick points today, and if you had any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. Just a generation or two ago, a disabled veteran looked different. Today, we don't look the same. And what I mean by that is oftentimes, historically, when you would look at a disabled veteran, you would see their disability with your eyes. And that's not the case today. Today, the case is that we have become so advanced in our ability to take care of wounded soldiers that the types of injuries that they have, they're much more survivable. And so they tend to survive. And there are new types of injuries that disabled veterans suffer from, such as TBIs and concussion injuries and that sort of thing. So you might not see that. So the question would maybe, if somebody said, well, what would a disabled veteran be doing trapping? And that takes some physical capability and some activity. So that's kind of something I wanted to speak to, that we don't look the same as maybe we used to. The other thing that I thought I'd bring up was that the trapping is good for the veterans, especially disabled veterans, and the Department of Fish and Game. Oftentimes they need to meet their goals. And then also the activity itself, being outdoors, doing these sorts of things are good for veterans to participate in. And then the third point I wanted to bring up is that historically, if you buy a hunting, fishing, and trapping license, it's fairly simple. You can choose that license at the Department of Fish and Game and purchase that license. So right now it can actually be confusing or difficult to navigate that system to go back and not only have your disabled veteran license, but to go in because you don't have a standard hunting and fishing license. Now you've got to get a trapping license, and so that can be confusing for some people. I wanted to thank the chair and the committee and the sponsors of the bill, and hope that you'll approve this bill today. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Okay, Mr. Summers, Rep. McCabe has a question.
Not really a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But through the chair, thank you for your service, and you should consider being a spokesman for other vets group. You're very well spoken, and I appreciate everything you said about our veterans. And again, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe.
Okay. Thank any you. Other questions for Mr. Summers?
Don't go yet.
Sorry. Pardon me.
No. You're not dismissed yet.
I'm so sorry. I beg your pardon.
No. Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Summers, for your service and for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Do we have anyone on the line? Okay. No one on the line, and no one else wishes to testify here today. All right. Public testimony is closed. Okay, Senator Keel, can you come back up? And Mr. Rep. Rouser has a question.
Hey, good morning, Senator. I appreciate it. Through the chair, I wasn't here when it was presented before. So if I ask a question that's been done before, I apologize ahead of time. But I have a question. If a veteran is disabled, and I see what says 50% or better, and they have to shoot mechanically. They have to shoot mechanically because of their limb. I was wondering, is that addressed in here? Because I'm not sure that that's legal in the state of Alaska, but I just want to know how it's handled in here, if it is at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to the vice chair, the bill does not speak to the methods and means of trapping. This does not make any changes to how a person would pursue their trapping. This would just speak to their ability to receive that lifetime card for hunting, fishing, and trapping as a service-disabled veteran.
Okay, I understand. Thank you very much. I thank you for the answer to the chair.
Any other questions for the sponsor? Somebody's got to be first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wright.
Through the chair, Senator, how many veterans do you think would partake in this percentage-wise? I know that there's a lot to do fishing and hunting, but, you know, trapping, is that like a small amount of folks that do it?
Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Wright, today there are a grand total of about 700 standalone trapping licenses sold in the state of Alaska. Only a subset of those are sold to people who are service-disabled veterans with that card to hunt and fish. It is possible that having a less confusing system will lead more service-disabled vets to take up trapping. But I think that influence will probably be relatively small. So while I don't have a strong estimate, the Department of Fish and Game estimates a negligible impact financially. They've given it a zero fiscal note as a result. I think the number of increase will be pretty small.
Follow up.
Okay, follow up.
Well, I just want to say thank you for bringing this bill forward. I really appreciate it, being a disabled veteran myself. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, it's an honor.
We'll expect to see you out on the trap line, Representative Wright.
Absolutely.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Keel. A couple of years ago, there was a bill passed to allow state hunting and fishing licenses to be legally displayed on a cell phone instead of having to carry the actual card or piece of paper. Would that same courtesy or convenience extend to the people, to the disabled veterans who obtain a trapping license?
Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Sadler, yes, the department's plan is to offer these license types through their app as well.
Right on. Okay, thank you.
Okay, very well. Are there any other questions for Senator Keel? Okay, would you like to make any closing comments, Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, I thank the committee for its time and consideration, and I know that several members of your committee have served our country in the armed forces, and we appreciate your service.
Okay, thank you, Senator Keel. I'll now ask for the will of the committee, and is there a motion? Representative Rush.
I move that the Senate Bill 10, Work Order 33 LS0150-A, be reported from the committee with the individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, Senate Bill 10 has been reported from the House Resources Committee with individual recommendations and 2-0 fiscal notes. We will take a brief at ease to sign the report. Okay, we're back on the record with House Bill 50, Carbon Storage. Today we have with us two members of the leadership of the Department of Natural Resources, Mr. O'Quinn and Mr. Crowther. They have a presentation for us following up on our past meetings. So, gentlemen, if you'd come to the table, state your name and your affiliation and begin your presentation. This will be the seventh hearing on HB 50. And we will hear their presentation. And let's pause for questions after each slide. Gentlemen, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you, Chair McKay. For the record, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for the time today for the committee, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. O'Quinn.
Good afternoon, Chair McKay and committee members. We're coming back to you for the seventh hearing today to talk to you and address some questions that committee members have had over the past few hearings and that have been submitted to the staff here. So we're going to kind of just give revisit some of the global overview statistics of the market for carbon, just restate kind of world emissions and where Alaska fits into that as far as being a container for those emissions. And then we're going to talk through some revenue scenarios. I believe these will be kind of illustrative of particular opportunities that may be available in Alaska, given some of our current emissions facilities, and then just kind of talk through some of the risks and opportunities that the bill presents to the state. So without further ado.
And Chair McKay, I would just note for the committee, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner again. These revenue scenarios are very hypothetical. There's significant assumptions in them. It's not a prediction, but we're providing them to contextualize the issue and just provide kind of a framework for the committee to understand the potentials in the bill.
Thanks. So just globally, you know, we're looking at between 30 and 35 gigatons of CO2 emissions from energy-related activities. So that's generally considered power generation. So 35 gigatons is 35 billion tons of CO2 emitted. Not all of those sources are feasibly captured or easily captured right now. The primary targets for CCUS in the power generating sector at the moment is coal-fired generation. The concentration of CO2 and the velocity of the flue gas are such that's the most technologically feasible way to capture CO2 from the energy or the generating industry. And then just to kind of put Alaska in perspective there, you know, if the world is 35 billion tons, Alaska is only 14 million tons of CO2. So it's, you know, Alaska is not a significant a significant contributor to that global emissions.
Okay. Rep. Sadler has a question.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn. I think I heard you say that 35 gigatons equals 35 billion tons?
Yes, Representative Sadler.
Okay, good. Because once we get into the gigas, I just lose it. Too big.
So I'd like to ask a question also. I guess just to be really clear, the x-axis on the graph is by year, and the y-axis is gigatons per year for the entire planet.
That's correct.
Since 1991, and the 0.014 gigaton per year looks like that's the actual CO2 production from everything in Alaska.
That's correct.
Which is obviously just a small fraction of the global.
Chair McKay,
that's correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. I just thought we should make sure of that before we... So, Rep. Rauscher.
Thank you. Through the chair, since you led off with that, so what is that projected to be in dollars and cents?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, we'll be getting to that in just a moment if I may delay answering your question.
Sure. Thanks.
If I could.
Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. And instead of 0.014 gigatons, could we put it in? Oh, I was going to ask a question. No, I'm sorry. Back off. This is the actual emissions, or this is the potential from all sources, the 14 million tons?
So the 14 million tons from Alaska is based on our inventory of there's a greenhouse gas emissions inventory that's done through the EPA. And so we looked at that. So that's an actual number for 2022.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed.
And then just to kind of revisit a few concepts that were so well explained by our state geologist, Dr. David LePain, we've got three main storage tanks for CO2 in Alaska. We've got the unminable coals, we've got saline aquifers, so those are collections of salt water deep beneath the earth and sedimentary formations. And then we've got depleted oil and gas fields. So we've had a characterization of our unminable coals done, and that's we've got that pegged at nearly 50 gigatons. Saline aquifers and depleted oil and gas fields haven't been well inventoried in the literature. You know, we obviously know our oil and gas fields very well and have an idea of those storage containers, but saline aquifers they're everywhere. They're hard to quantify without drilling a well, so we haven't done that yet, and it'll take a lot more research to do that. But in general, they're considered to be much more prolific than coal seams, and so a larger storage tank. And again, we know our oil fields, but we haven't characterized the breadth of that storage tank in the literature. But just going back, you know, we're at 30 to 35 gigatons worldwide emissions per year, and Alaska has 50 gigatons available just in its unminable coals. So we could hold more than the world's emissions for 1 year in our unminable coal seams.
Okay, Rep. McCabe has a question.
Thanks. Through the chair, so this brings up maybe a real-world example, and I don't even care at this point how much money it would make or lose, but in my district, we have a power plant that's getting ready to shut down, a coal-fired power plant. We are already struggling with our electrical generation, with our extension cord from Homer to Fairbanks and the natural gas starting to be depleted, which runs the power in South Central. And we're going to shut down a coal-fired plant up around Healy because it's a coal-fired power plant. It seems like I know that it has some struggles operationally, but it seems the main reason they're going to shut it down is because it's burning that nasty coal, even though Alaska coal is among the cleanest in the world, but it is a coal-fired plant. The Air Force has already shut down the Fort Greely power plant because by doing so, they could completely get rid of their carbon usage or their carbon off, off-gassing for the entire Air Force. That is required by the government for them to get rid of. So my question is, I mean, it's right at the top of this blue area. We could sequester our emissions from that second power plant fairly easily and save all kinds of transportation costs, keep a coal-fired generating plant online, and it wouldn't even really matter how much money they made from it because, frankly, we need the electricity. I mean, we're struggling with rail-belt electricity anyway. So, I mean, do you see that as am I way off base here, or is this something that we actually are considering, maybe to boil it down to a one-word answer?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, yes, that's one of the major drivers of this bill is that, we're seeing these things internationally, but we're seeing them in state too. Different folks are saying we shouldn't use this kind of energy source or we shouldn't have this plant operational because of the emissions, because of the carbon emissions. And we think this gives an ability for those kind of plants to say, if you would like our plant to continue, reliable power, cheap fuel for the power, reliable output, we have a way to sequester and limit the emissions so we can keep using that energy source, keep providing that power. So we see in-state electric generation from a coal resource as a potential candidate for CCUS project that would potentially allow that plant to continue to operate.
Thank you.
Rep. Rauscher has a question.
Yeah, thank you to the chair, to Representative McCabe. We heard your argument in energy, and basically John Burns told us that the problem with it is keeping the plant running. It's the dinosaur. It's costing him a fortune in fixing and parts and maintenance. I don't think that to state that the coal is the main reason for them not wanting to keep that plant operating. I had no other argument. I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Rep. Rauscher. Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn. So just want to make sure I understand saline aquifers, depleted oil and gas fields, which is what we've been talking about most, but just want to clarify. So there's almost 50 gigatons of storage inside the coal that is unminable. I guess I always kind of presumed we'd have to empty out the pore space or empty out the mineral space before we could put something in, but this is actually space in and around the coal. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I don't want to step into the geology lane too much, but basically you would be pressurizing the carbon, and so that while there are molecules occupying a lot of that pore space, methane oftentimes, there would be room for the carbon dioxide to also occupy space in those coal seams.
Okay, please continue.
So on the next slide, we'll be presenting three hypothetical kind of revenue opportunities for the state. And I just wanted to walk the members through some assumptions that we're relying on for these scenarios. Again, as Deputy Commissioner Crowther mentioned, these are very hypothetical, very much developed. We feel like they rely on reasonable economic assumptions, but we really want to caveat that they're designed to kind of illustrate magnitudes and not specific numbers. So we're not making any promises about revenue on the next slide. The ultimate caveat that we're trying to make here. But in any case, so we're going to look at three facilities, one being a regional power facility. So that would be similar to a Healy, one of the units at Healy. I believe the emissions from Healy are about 600,000 tons per year, split equally about between the two units there. So we've got this pegged at 250,000 metric tons. And then what we did is we relied on using those numbers that were that appeared in the first part of the bill, the first version of the bill, that $2.50 per ton injection fee and that $20 per acre rental fee for the non-injecting years. We assumed for the first two that they would have a 20-year life. And then we made some reasonable assumptions about the acreage that they would be using. based on scaling up from known facilities in the world. And then on the North Slope facility, we determined that maybe 50% of the CO2 stream would be used for EOR and 50% of it might be used for pure sequestration. And then finally, our third slide, we're looking at a 40-year life just because we would predict that that would be kind of the more long-term, or excuse me, they're all long-term, but longer-term project and larger scale project. So we're looking at a small facility, a medium-sized facility, and a large facility basically here.
Okay, Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just looking at this conceptual design of a CO2 carrier. How many tons could that type of carrier carry?
Representative Armstrong, through the chair, I think at this stage the ocean-going transshipment of CO2 is still very much under assessment. So I don't know what different volumes those tankers are targeting, but I don't think there's we're reliably able to say this kind of volume is being shipped today. So, the more you can get on a tanker, the more the economics are improved. So I imagine they're intending to ship hundreds of millions, if not billions of tons, if possible. But I don't want to speculate beyond just more is better in that business. But I think it's still being studied.
Thank you.
I would, Rep. Armstrong, and gentlemen, I would expect it to be similar to LNG tankers because you're liquefying it, and it's a gas, so probably something similar to what an LNG tanker can haul. I'm not an expert in that area, but that's where I would start.
And I think some of the concepts that we've seen in this, Representative Armstrong through the chair, some of the concepts we've seen in this type of operation would be the CO2 would be essentially backhaul. We would export hydrogen or through ammonia or some other commodity, and then the CO2 would come as backhaul from those countries to which we imported that commodity. So the same volumes.
Okay, please continue.
So again, just to revisit some of these caveats, not all CO2 emissions are feasibly captured currently. We have a lot of developing technology, and our primary easily captured CO2 method right now is from industrial processes like gas treatment plants or ammonia production, that sort of thing. But that technology is continuing to rapidly develop, especially we've seen government support for those technologies through the 45Q tax credit and other sort of research grant types of initiatives through the Department of Energy. The capital expenditures for these projects, especially on retrofitting existing plants, so this might be applicable to Healy, are very high. The benefits of the emission or the sequestration project can't overcome those initial capital expenditures, but there are a lot of opportunities for support in those capital expenditures, and more we're seeing that become less of a barrier. And then finally, that import scenario, it's really dependent on further development of shipping technology and the infrastructure to load those ships and offload them. So these are hypothetical.
Okay, just a footnote here, Rep. Armstrong, modern LNG tankers carry between 125,000 and 150,000 cubic meters of LNG. So I have to convert that to tons, but cool. We try to answer every question here. Okay, please continue, gentlemen.
Okay, so here's the numbers. So with our regional power facility, we're looking at this 20-year life, like we mentioned. So in all these facilities, we assume the acquisition of the property rights, an exploration phase of 3 years or so before injection starts. And then a ramp up of injection, after year five or so. So over that 20-year life, in terms of injection fees and annual rental fees, this is a non-discounted cash flow. This is just a straight, adding up all the years without adjusting for inflation.
we're looking at about $11.8 million. You'll notice a few other lines in these different scenarios. We have an additional EOR revenue, or EOR oil revenue, and then a reduction in our pollution charges. And, you know, the idea there is we wanted to show that in some areas where we capture this carbon, that injection could lead to additional production. And, you know, we did that based on assumptions for how our the injection of natural gas enhances our production in those areas. We made some geologic assumptions about the impact that that CO2 would have on that reservoir and how many barrels it might produce. And then on the reduced pollution charges, when you capture CO2, you may also have the opportunity to capture certain regulated pollutants. And what that means is the operator would not be polluting because they would be capturing that pollution, and therefore some of the charges that are incurred by that operator for polluting the air, they would not pay necessarily to the Department of Environmental Conservation. This is all very, very hypothetical. We just wanted to demonstrate that that could be a potential impact possibly at some point in the future if they were taking pollutants out of the air in addition to carbon dioxide. So with the scenario...
No, go ahead. Complete okay. Your...
With scenario number one, we're looking at about $11.8 million. With scenario number two, about twice this, significantly larger than scenario number one, we're looking at about $210 million over the 20-year period. And then over a 40-year period, assuming all of the amounts stayed the same, that the injection charge didn't change, that the rental didn't go up, all of these things, we'd be looking at about $1 billion. So these are non-discounted cash flow models. They're just straight line revenue in the dollars of the first year. So.
Okay, Rep. Sadler, you had a question?
Thank you, I do. And through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn, this is not specifically about the chart here, but you just mentioned the point that capturing carbon dioxide will also possibly capture other pollutants. My question is this: does the bill HB 50 envision injecting those additional pollutants? Is there any standard as to how pure the CO2 needs to be to qualify for injection under this bill?
We do have a definite, Representative Sadler, through the chair, we do have a definition of carbon dioxide in the bill, and it does require a certain purity, or that it be of a certain purity. The bill itself does not define that purity, that we would rely on the regulating agency, the AOGCC, to make that determination. But for purposes of the tax credits, for purposes of pipeline standards, there would be certain purity requirements for the CO2 for transportation and to meet the standards of those tax credits. And so there would be regulation on that, but we felt that the bill was not the most the statutory level was not the most appropriate level to define those standards.
And Representative Sadler, through the chair, if I can add there, those kind of pollutants today are either being emitted subject to regulations and permits and fees or citations assessed for that at times, or they're being managed consistent with existing authority and regulation. And so the items that would be removed from these streams, potentially, theoretically, there's existing protocols in place for managing those different things. You know, methane, carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide. Those things have existing protocols, and so it doesn't require new adaptations. This is just acknowledging that if you were treating either flue stack emissions, natural gas feedstocks, or other parts of the industrial process, you might have these products appear in that you would have to be managed according to existing regulation and law. So some of them may be disposed of in different ways, but we're not proposing that they necessarily be injected into for CO2 sequestration.
That's a good one to hear then. Thanks. Otherwise, we might need to get into quality banks for the, you know, how much is CO2 by volume versus other pollutants, et cetera, et cetera. But sounds like that's taken care of upstream.
Okay. Rep. Mears?
Thank you. I'd just like to clarify. So for the exploration license and development lease portions of this, those are the per acres. So in the exploration, it's a larger area, and then development is when you kind of narrow down and focus in on an area. So those are the income for those two line items.
Representative Mears, through the chair, that's correct. So we'll have a larger acreage number for exploration licensing. You figure out where they want to inject. They kind of reduce their property rights entitlement. You can see that reflected in kind of the magnitude of the numbers between year two and year three. And then, you know, they hold that property right while they're doing their construction or acquiring their permits. And then they stop paying that rent once they start injecting.
Follow-up?
Yes, please. It says that this chart is best case, and we've chatted about, you know, having multiple cases in here. I'm going to jump ahead a little in the presentation and say there's a reference to an updated fiscal note, which we don't have yet, which shows the Class 6 primacy getting taken care of probably by federal grants, and then a zero fiscal note for the AOGCC and DNR to come up with the regulations and start administering the program. Am I jumping too far ahead here, sir?
No. Please proceed.
Okay. So I'm just checking in on that math.
Representative Mears, through the chair, I believe in the next slide we have a summary of kind of risks that talks about, in a sense, the costs that we would incur if in a zero development scenario. And I think your characterization of it is largely accurate in the sense that the fiscal note amounts, and these will be forthcoming from the departments, that have been reduced, and we don't anticipate a lot of other costs. So I hope that answers your question. It may not.
Just clarifying. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Crowther, on the second scenario here, the North Slope Facility standalone CCOS project that could potentially generate $210 million over 20 years. Help me scope, is that the entire North Slope, or is that one particular field, or help me understand how much of the entire potential emissions from this North Slope this considers?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'm going to go back two slides to our hypothetical revenue opportunities just to kind of demonstrate what we're talking about. So the North Slope emitting facility, we have two really big emissions facilities on the North Slope. I shouldn't say really big, but the two largest emissions facilities on the North Slope are the central processing facility, and then I'm drawing a blank now. I believe it's a power plant on the North Slope. I believe they're both in Prudhoe Bay, but it's basically one is 2 million tons a year and one is 3 million tons a year. So this is assuming a when I say standalone, I mean it's not AK LNG, it's not part of the gas line. This is existing facilities on the North Slope. So we've got a 2 million ton per year emitter on the North Slope currently. So this is just one facility, one air permit on the North Slope. Or I shouldn't say air permit, one emitter on the North Slope.
So if you added another 3 million for the other facility, you could scale up the number. Right.
That's correct.
Chair McKay, that's correct. John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, for the record. That's correct. And there are additional facilities and operations beyond those core Prudhoe Bay facilities that have further emissions still. So the total volume of North Slope emissions higher still than that 5 million. But we included this because it is concentrated from essentially single existing source.
Okay. And just... if I may add, Chair McKay, just to remind everyone, the total emissions for Alaska are 14 million tons per year.
Okay, very good. Any other? Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you. Back on slide 7, if that's okay. Just here through the chair, it seems like it takes about 5 or 6 years before we start realizing those injection fees. Can you walk me through or remind me why it takes 5 years? Is it because this is the first batch? Could that time period be shrunk through anything that we can do? Just help me understand that time horizon.
Yeah. Rep. Armstrong, through the chair, I'll just kind of remind everyone about our process and the statute for exploration licensing. You know, the first thing that has to happen is a bit of a site characterization. Then they have to go through the property rights acquisition process, that best interest finding process where they submit a proposal to us. So there's some competing proposals. And then once they receive that entitlement, they have to go out on the land and do some exploration. It could be that they already know the subsurface really well, and so they would be able to inject in a more timely manner. But I think at this point, what we're seeing for, you know, what we would expect in Alaska and what we are seeing in the lower 48 is that it does take quite a while to look at the subsurface, to get comfortable with that, and then just to build out infrastructure. This is oftentimes large industrial infrastructure. If you're retrofitting a coal-fired power plant, it takes a long time to build in those facilities. If you're building a pipeline, it takes a while to build that, especially in Alaska with our seasonal construction periods and our seasonal exploration periods. And so we would expect that that five-year timeline is reasonable for Alaska, and maybe could even possibly be longer for Alaska, depending on the construction seasons and that sort of thing.
Okay. Okay, Rep. Mears?
I had another question, but I'll start with a follow-up to this one. So it seems that scenario two might be the more likely one to start first, and as there's still as there's some injections going on now. So would some of those operations be more turnkey and not need as much exploration and development?
Representative Mears, through the chair, it is certainly possible that, you know, and this is a very hypothetical timeline, but one of the things that, and for many projects, could occupy a lot of that upfront timeline is understanding the geologic space you're intending to sequester. In a scenario where an operator had a good understanding of either existing depleted reservoirs or existing producing reservoirs for purposes of enhanced oil recovery, or other adjacent, you know, as they've characterized the area, they understand other formations that could be susceptible, they may be able to speed that characterization work up. Things like facility permitting construction still could occupy a significant amount of that upfront time. But I think it is very fair to say that, you know, in hypothetical project two would likely have a better understanding of its targeted geology and the formations it might utilize than hypothetical scenarios one or three.
Follow up?
Just the quick ones. Thank you, through the chair. So is it more likely that Alaska would start with scenario two?
Representative Mears, through the chair, I think it's hard for us to say more likely. I think a project that has more defined characteristics is naturally ahead in the process. And so that's a, you know, we included this one because it's a ready-made example of, you know, if there is a technological capacity, capital capacity, corporate ability to do so, it's a project we could see developing quite quickly because the location, the infrastructure, the geology does not need to be developed. Obviously, a project that didn't have that would have to go through those first category of elements as well as identify a basin, a source, et cetera. So it does, in a general sense, it seems like a more likely project to start, but it's not our position to say, you know, when or how it might come together.
At the risk of getting stuck on this one slide much longer, it would be interesting to see another scenario where we build the gas pipeline and how much CO2 would be scrubbed out for the rate that the current project is. I can't remember how much gas that the current project is predicting. I know it's a 42-inch pipeline, 60 per day, I believe.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Mr. Crowther, if you remember how much natural gas they were going to put through that, but that might be a fourth scenario that might be, well, it'd probably be the same as number two, I think, but it'd just be a greater volume, huh?
Well,
make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, Chair McKay. I think, you know, the scenario two is the existing facilities, you know, the production of power, but also the pressurization reinjection of produced methane back into the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir, capturing some of the emissions associated with that. Were there to be a major gas sale essentially a large, much larger volume of gas would be processed to remove all the CO2. So it would be significantly larger than scenario two, but I think we would need to just make sure I don't do my math on the fly and embarrass myself.
I just wanted to point that out for the committee that, you know, over the long term, that could be something that might add to these numbers significantly.
Thank you, Chair McKay.
Okay.
Chair McKay, if I may just add to that, the CO2 that would be processed at that gas treatment plant would most likely be used for enhanced oil recovery. So it would result in additional barrels of oil, but not necessarily revenues under the carbon capture regime here.
Okay. I didn't know if we knew that for sure or not.
We don't know for sure.
Okay. All right, we better move on then. Next slide, guys.
So Representative Mears earlier asked about kind of, I believe, what we're getting at here. And that's kind of what is the risk of the state for, you know, we set up this program and nobody comes to the table. And I think, you know, what we really wanted to illustrate here is that we believe that the industry is ready to bring projects to Alaska. We don't have a project in hand. We're not designing this legislation around a specific project, but we are we're very excited about the prospects. But that being said, that is a possibility that we would not have a project. And so we really wanted to illustrate that, you know, even if that worst case scenario came true, that what we're looking at, especially with the revised fiscal notes, would be a very low risk to the state. We are asking for that over $1 million for FY24 for two full-time positions with the AOGCC. However, and included in your most recent packet is a copy of the AOGCC's letter of intent to seek EPA grant funds for the Underground Injection Control Class 6 grant program. We believe that those costs could be covered by that grant for the first several years in order to stand up the AOGCC's regulatory program. The licensing program at DNR, I run the leasing section of the Division of Oil and Gas. We have a really impressive group of people there that are extremely good at data management. We've got all of our lease sales running on online bidding systems. We've really run, thanks to those folks in my department, a really, really tight ship over the last few years that have really, really set us up for success and given us capacity to take something like this on and set it up. You know, it would be an initial lift of those folks to get this program set up, but I believe we could handle that in-house. And so we will be revising our fiscal note to be a zero expenditure for FY24 and out years. We have additional technical needs within the Division of Oil and Gas, geologists, economists, that sort of thing. But again, you know, I think we would be comfortable coming back to the legislature for those funds when we have a specific need for those. So when we have industry knocking on our door, then we could bring those folks on, or we could start with contracts or something like that. But I believe we can stand up the program in the Division of Oil and Gas in DNR without taking on additional staff at this time. And that would be something that we could come back to the legislature for as the industry coalesces. So DEC has possible theoretical reductions in their revenues based on a reduced pollution. But again, those are very theoretical, and those would require those projects to be at an operational stage. And as you all know, and from our hypotheticals, that's several years out from even initially acquiring those property rights from the department. And so we could deal with that a little bit at a later date. But we just wanted to point out that is a possible impact to just be as forthcoming as possible with you all in our fiscal note.
Chair McKay, for the record, John Crowther, if I could just add one more thing to this slide. We talked about these risks in terms of incurred costs today, describing them as very low. I just would go back to slide 7. In the scenario, you know, for example, a scenario with very little industry activity or interest, maybe we see no activity at all. If we see any, we see some exploration licenses acquired. We can see here, you know, depending on the size of those, that's $100,000 of revenue, maybe a few hundred thousand dollars of revenue. So even if we saw just a few exploration licenses, they never progressed to development leases, there never any injection occurred, we'd still see potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars of state revenue compared to our risks of very de minimis costs offset in the case of the AOGCC with federal grant funds. So we think that on balance is a very, the worst case scenario is very protective and positive.
Okay, Rep. McCabe has a question.
So thanks, through the chair. I think what I just heard you say is that the $456,000 fiscal note for the DNR will be zeroed out now?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, we're anticipating when we receive a CS to revise our fiscal notes to reflect zero for DNR.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
So just, you know, kind of building off of what Deputy Commissioner Crowther just mentioned, we've got a high potential here. You saw this, those scenarios, you know, if things get built out, if injection starts, we're seeing, you know, really, really pretty significant opportunities for revenue. But even if they don't, you know, it's relatively low risk. You know, the other thing that this does is it kind of builds industry that can develop enhanced oil recovery and really try to extend the life of our existing royalty revenues by providing these additional opportunities for decarbonization. So you have the EOR concept. You also have just this, the general principle that a lot of these corporations have emissions targets that they're trying to reach. And by allowing them to reach those targets in Alaska, you're extending the life of Alaska projects. You are making Alaska a more attractive investment environment. The ability to attract capital by being able to be carbon, to reduce carbon intensity. And so, you know, as I mentioned, we do have that opportunity for enhanced oil recovery. And then, you know, just to remind the committee members that those revenues, those mineral revenues, are split between the general fund and the permanent fund per the Constitution. And so it helps grow Alaska for the long term and helps preserve, you know, this existing technical workforce that that has built up around the oil and gas industry. There's a lot of analogs. You're drilling wells, you're building pipelines, you have engineers, you have geologists. So, you know, you have a pretty broad-based technical workforce that would be able to be preserved. And then these also provide additional opportunities for our generating facilities to decarbonize and just diversify our base power.
Okay, Ken? Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn, you mentioned that some of this would provide revenue to the permanent fund and general fund. Would both the injection fee and the rental fee revenue streams be subject to that 25% deposit to the permanent fund, or would it just be rental?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe I believe all mineral revenue is split per the Constitution. So.
Okay, I have a couple final questions for today. Could you talk a little more about how the state will manage the long-term liability associated with storage projects, and would the state need insurance? I think just for the record, we probably need to restate all that. It might have been discussed in previous meetings, but let's be sure we have a clear answer on that, gentlemen.
Yeah, Chair McKay, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, I'll just speak at a high level and then let Aaron supplement. But in sense, as a project develops, there'll be a fee and an assessment by the state that will go into a fund, a long-term fund for managing liability. That doesn't mean that while the project is operating, that the state has liability. That's the project operator. So that liability continues with the operator during their operations, have to do them safely. And then it continues with the operator while they review with the AOGCC the potential closure of the facility. Then the AOGCC has to approve that closure. The operator continues that liability. Then after a period, the liability goes to the state. The title of the carbon the project reverts to the state. At that time, the state has that fund, both from that project and any other projects, that has been accumulating to deal with any issues that may be identified. After all of the closure, all the regulatory confirmation is in place. It's possible the state may desire to produce or procure insurance for those risks out of that fund, in different prudent management of that fund. It's also quite possible that the expected liabilities would be quite low, the fund balance would continue to accumulate, and from a actuarial or a risk assessment, we'd be very well covered. And so that is the general framework for managing long-term liability.
Okay, Rep. Sadler, question?
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate the answer. That's good to know. So the question arises, looking back at the chart with the complicated chart with the revenue. So how much of the revenue that is described for the North Slope Emitting Facility would need to be retained in a trust fund? And how much would go the, can you get to that level of specificity? How much would go the trust fund versus general fund versus permanent fund?
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair, just to remind the committee members, this revenue picture is not looking at those injection fees, which would be assessed by the regulatory agency. So those are kind of analogous to the regulatory cost charge that the AOGCC currently assesses against industry, or that, for instance, the DEC assesses against polluters. Those fees are assessed by the AOGCC, and they're established in their permit or in regulation, and those are two components. You have the administrative fee, which is that year-to-year kind of charge that's assessed by the AOGCC in order for them to cover the permitting activities. And then you have the long-term closure fund, which is assessed also by the AOGCC and established in their permit or in regulation. And that's saved, so to speak, for the day when the state may take on that liability. And these fees are what is paid to the state for the proprietary use of the property, right, of the pore space. So we are the landowner, and this is the money we are getting for wearing that hat.
My apologies. That's the best dollar chart we've had yet, so pardon me for making that assumption.
Okay, I have one more question. Can you walk us through how the DNR will manage competing land uses when these leases are issued, for example, public use, oil and gas extraction versus storage, which will take precedence, which would dominate? Is that clear? How do you, gentlemen, take sure. A shot at that?
Yeah, Representative McKay, we envision this would, as far as the surface conflicts, we envision this would work just like the oil and gas industry does today. The state does control access to the surface at Prudhoe Bay for certain reasons, but with allowances made for subsistence uses, for community uses, it would be much the same way. It's a very similar operation. There would not be exclusivity except in instances where, for safety reasons, it was required. And again, these are small footprints. I'll remind committee members of the North Dakota example, where we had the one injection well and one or two monitoring wells. So very small surface footprint, maybe some pipelines on the surface. So you typically don't have a ton of surface impacts. And then what we've done in the law is we've required notification of these types of projects to mineral owners in the area, including the state and other mineral lessees. We've empowered the agency, the AOGCC, to mitigate those conflicts as far as setting spacing, pool rules, that sort of thing, to govern the drilling through one horizon over another. And we've really laid out that, you know, this is not intended to interfere with the mineral estate at all. And I apologize, I don't have the bill right in front of me, and I could come back to the committee with some citations to those. But we have thought about that, and other states have thought about that. And the idea is that this is not designed to trump oil and gas production.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. If we're doing general questions, I got a general question. assuming, through the chair, Mr. Quinn, assuming we go through the process and we inject a whole bunch of CO2, we go through the P&A process and we save the liability. 5-10 years later, we find out that there's a need for that CO2 in the market, whether for EOR, for some commercial use. Does the state have the ability, the power to access a closed and capped storage reservoir and basically use that gas for commercial purpose, or maybe sell it back to somebody else, maybe the first people that injected in the first place? Does it have value to us, and can we get at it?
So, Representative Sadler, through the chair, in short answer, the title transfers to the state, and we own that CO2. So, in theory, if someone wanted to make beneficial use of it, it would be a state resource available for us to sell, monetize at that time. Now, of course, to get to it, it would require technical and operational something operationally and technically complex to drill back in, produce it responsibly, safely and responsibly. But in that title accrues to the state, and it's the state's. Similarly, if a storage operator in the course of their operations, they might identify that some of their CO2 they wanted to store, some they wanted to sell or ship to some other user for beneficial use. So they might choose to do that during the duration of their operations. But if at conclusion, it's owned by the state and someone then wanted to make use of it, it would be ours to manage.
And a follow-up?
Okay, follow-up.
If for any reason and through the chair, an operator did not want to surrender control of the injected CO2, if they wanted to keep it past 10 years, would that be possible? Does this bill envision and allow for that?
So, Representative Sadler, through the chair, I hesitate to speculate too much about all sorts of scenarios, but, as an existing oil and gas operation, depending on the economics and commercial decisions of the operator, can continue to produce very small volumes. In the West, U.S. West, they talk about stripper wells that are producing sometimes a barrel or two or a dozen barrels a day. Similarly, a carbon storage operator may choose to inject a very small amount of carbon as the project matures or as they receive less. Now, the rate and process for injection would be subject to their permit, subject to AOGCC regulations. So they couldn't do anything that would be contrary to those, but it's possible they would want to maintain a project at a low level for a long time, perhaps waiting for beneficial use of CO2, perhaps waiting for more CO2 to inject. So it's possible they may want to continue to maintain it for a long, long time.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Rep. Mears.
Thank you. Through the chair, I really appreciate getting additional information, some potential, ins and outs and scenarios. I'm still wrapping my head around some of this, and I'm digesting, so I don't have all the questions I'll have for you at the tip of my tongue right now, because there's various things that come into play with the enhanced oil recovery, how different taxes and things work. So I'm working on homework with that, and I'm also working to understand the air quality program implications. It's an area that I haven't done any work in the past, so I'm doing more homework on that as well. So I just wanted to say thank you for what we've got in there, and I'll work on if I've got more questions that are coming up for my homework. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for today? Okay, thank you, Mr. Crowther, Mr. O'Quinn, for coming before us again. We appreciate all your work on this, and we look forward to receiving back from the revisers the updated committee substitute, possibly by tomorrow or Wednesday, with updated fiscal notes. I will now set HB 50 aside until we're ready to adopt a CS. And in closing, is there any other business? Okay, so seeing none, the next committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, March 1st. And I would announce to you that we plan to have our first hearing on HB 49, which is the carbon offset bill, which I refer to as the tree bill informally. So you can look forward to that on Wednesday. And please try to wrap up your work on HB 50 as soon as you can. So with that, I will adjourn the meeting at 2:12 p.m.